Welcome to the Twidge Show. I am Chris Wink, your host and CEO of Technically, a new site about local economies and change. Each week, the Twidge Show dives into topics of building better companies with leaders who are doing just that. We are an extension of Technically's This Week in Jobs newsletter, which you can join at Technically Subscribe. This month is Racial Equity in Tech Month in Technically's editorial calendar, a topic that has coincided with one of the most consequential moments in the history of conversation about American racial equity. A gruesome video of a white police officer in Minneapolis killing an unarmed black man named George Floyd sparked weeks of protests around the country, indeed the world, from tens of thousands in big cities to inspiring gatherings in small towns. Though the spark is painfully unremarkable, the killing of an unarmed black man, it has proven so powerful and so widespread that so many people are sick and tired of being sick and tired that this is a flashpoint. No workplace can ignore this moment, and no workplace should ever ignore this issue. That is why on today's episode of The Twidge Show, we are talking, how do you talk about race at work? We'll discuss that. I'm joined by two friends from Philadelphia-based diversity consulting firm Cultured Enough. JL KDLV Chambers is president of Cultured Enough. He's an emerging voice in topics focusing on diversity, multi-ethnic leadership, culture diversity, race, gender, racial identity, and development. He's passionate about helping leaders, organizations, not just function, but also thrive in diverse settings and how they think, react, communicate, and serve when it comes to each other's community and ethnicities. JL holds a master's in urban studies and a concentration in cultural psychology. Hey, JL, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brother Chris.
Also have Alyssa Vasquez. She's a diversity and inclusion trainer for Cultured Enough. Her passion is to enable people of diverse backgrounds with a seat at the table while shaping decisions and challenging the status quo. She's a Bachelor of Arts degree in International Relations at American University. Alyssa, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
So let's start off. This is one of the most serious moments we've had in a very serious topic. It's unfortunate that it takes infrequent moments to have this kind of scrutiny on such a widespread and important issue. You guys have this conversation a lot. Is now too late to have the conversation? Is it the right time at work to be talking about it? Or is it too tired and it's the wrong time?
Yeah, I want to affirm, because that's a great question. What we've seen, and even the research shows, it's always the right time to talk about injustice, especially in the organizational sector. There's a great article that Harvard Business Review did a year ago, and it says, how do you be inclusive through a crisis? And it's so fascinating because some of the points, I'm going to highlight just three quick, that they make is that they say, acknowledging who's in the room and the status of who has privilege and who's not. And it's so interesting how sometimes we can go into work in our environments and we'll assume that everyone just had a great weekend. Or we assume that, like, hey, you know what, how's your day going? But if you're aware of what's happening, especially in the last 3 weeks, this is another traumatic moment for the African-American Black community that shows the lack of empathy towards people if they don't address it. And one of the things also it talks about is show compassion and to check in with employees that are from underrepresented groups. And so I would say it's always a good time to talk about injustice, especially when you see it at the scale that it's in and that it has not went away for the last 250 years once the Emancipation Proclamation allowed Black African-American people to be free.
Yeah, and to add to that, it's literally comes down to if you're a CEO of an organization or heading up a nonprofit, if you will, or starting your own company, if you desire to have diversity within your company, whether that's diversity in terms of your core group, who's leading, diversity in marketing, diversity in finance, if you desire that simple fact of diversity, it comes with that is nuances, because you're going to get people of different cultures. And when you get people of different cultures, it's in your best interest if you're able to know the cultures that have been underrepresented or the people who have not had a voice at the table. So it's up to you as well to be able to educate oneself in terms of if you're wanting the diversity and inclusive package at your company, comes with that is the opportunity to be able to learn about other cultures and to learn, like JL said, about what they're enduring and what their community is facing at the same time. And with that, sets your company up for success to be able to make better decisions in terms of your business in all aspects of the business. And so it comes with it. Like, if you want the diversity package, you also need to educate yourself in terms of the nuances of the different cultures that you want to include.
We've been reporting on 10 years, and on what always happens in a critical, crucial moment like this is we see a full range. Companies that have invested for years in having tough conversation, and they can respond well, and maybe they just need to adapt.
Yes.
We have folks who have never done the serious work, and it's just it's a dangerous dynamic. And we have ones who have engaged but done it badly, and it's like purely toxic. You have a full range. So I wonder, like, when you guys are first maybe onboarding a client or trying to do discovery, what are some of the questions that you ask or you'd recommend others to ask, to even assess? Are they like, have a foundation to build on? Are they like kind of dangerously voiceless, or is it toxic? You have any, how do you assess early days?
Yeah. So for us, we like to, and thank you, Chris, because I feel like it's very important before you hop into trying to even have a conversation or maybe spending time in training, we have to know, as a leader, you have to know what has happened in the past, what's currently happening. So we like to do a diversity audit to sort of understand, and we break that data through racial, gender differences, intersectionality, what are Black women, maybe Latinx women thinking compared to white counterparts. And why that's important is this. Everyone comes into the racial conversation in some ways uncomfortable, feeling comfortable, but out of trauma or out of a not the best experience. What we've seen many leaders do that is not helpful is that they just hop into an uncomfortable historical topic that the U.S. has always had to struggle with without setting the table down to have psychological safety. And so it's very interesting how being very people with good intentions create more trauma, and organizations come to us and say, well, we've tried this before. And usually when they say that, we say, what have you tried? And we see that what they've done, their foundation, and we say, yeah, it makes sense why it wasn't successful, because you said some statements or you did two trainings, but you didn't have any follow-up. Or how are you going to develop a task force? Are you going to change your policies? Are you going to develop structures for onboarding processes? So for us, it's been very simple. We like to say, understand your culture of your organization, assess, and you should have the conversation. The question is, how do you go about having this conversation well, and that's effective, and that you're actually seeing organizational change?
So good. So good. And to add to that, even how important leadership buy-in is, Chris. So I'm sure that you've also seen companies kind of say, maybe they even have a diversity task force, or maybe they have people of color who are willing to take the charge. Sometimes CEOs or people who are uncomfortable, like JL said, to having this conversation, they'll say, oh, you handle it and you deal with it, and then get back to me when you have the results, or get back to me when you start seeing change. But what Cultured Enough is what we emphasize, and before even an assessment, the first thing we do is talk with leadership, the CEOs, who's making the daily decisions, because that is the only way you're going to create change, is if we get the immediate leadership buy-in. It's not something that you can all. It has to be something that's so woven into the DNA of the ship buy-in from the company.
When you do that assessment, like particularly in a moment like this, but this conversation is evergreen. We will always be talking about engaging with the fundamental original sin of this country. How do you know when to call bullshit? Like when you're talking to that CEO or whomever, how do you know this organization wants to engage with this, as opposed to this is all fucking window dressing? Like signs?
Yeah, there are signs. And thank you for saying that, because that's, like we said, we assess, but that's one of the sexiest things we're seeing now, right now, is everyone, and good intention, and I don't know people's hearts. I have the most wokest Instagram and Facebook friends that I've ever had in the last 2 weeks. And what's interesting is that I don't know, but I can sort of see some of the postures. So for it's very simple. How long have you been doing this? So if a leader has been going on their own journey before they reach out, that's a good sign. If a leader says, I've done some training, I understand my biases, I see I have privilege, like that gives us like, okay, they understand that they're coming into this and they have to do some work. And then there's this truth of like, are you willing to challenge structures? And if they say we're going to do that, and then they put money behind it, because here's what I say, money, you don't have to have a lot of money, but when you think about diversity and inclusion, you have to put the resources towards it. You can't force staff for free that are working there of color to take the diversity flag, like you mentioned so well in your article you wrote about white organization leaders and why they're silent, is that we put staff of color to do a topic that they didn't get paid to do. So that means bringing outside people in to train and develop them and develop the team. And so we assess that before we even sign contracts. And if those are some things that are red flags, we literally say, hey, this we don't align with the organization. And I'm sorry, but there are other organizations that you can check the box. But for us, we believe we want to see organizational change. We want staff of color to stay. And we want white staff to feel like they're equipped to have these kinds and to grow as leaders, too.
Right, right. And Chris, to even, I mean, I like how you say it, like call out the BS, right? Like call it for what it is. And I think that your article is prominent because it talks about the effects of being silent, right? So even in the workplace, when you see microaggressions, when you see implicit bias, when you see all these nuances that I think people are not open to, call it out. Like call it for what it is, keep people accountable, because that's what it's going to come down to, right? It's like individual people's prejudice. And if we as a people are able to call out the those that are not in agreement with this movement and what's going on in the country, call the BS out. And that's when you start to make change within the microcosm that you can control.
True. I wonder if you could share some examples. You mentioned the diversity audit early on in the engagement. What are other efforts that you do with clients of yours, or you just would recommend other organizations think about doing? Just, they don't have to be comprehensive. What are some tactics or strategies you think are important if I'm trying to set the foundation or getting to be able to talk about race?
Yeah, so there are things you can do before even talking about race. I think all leaders first have to do their own self-evaluation, so like, and know some of their biases that they're coming into this. And so what we typically do, I've seen organizations that they want to go to the training. So they'll say, hey, we have five trainings. And trainings don't change behavior. Training actually just gives people knowledge. But even how we do trainings are somewhat, research shows forceful trainings don't work. So I mean, some training is good, but you can't say every staff should go to these eight trainings. The truth is you want to vet. You should do trainings and then do optional trainings. And who's showing up to those optional trainings? Those are the people who are going to run with the flag and take diversity and inclusion serious. Now there's expectations you should have across the board that all staff should be treated fairly, have interview process as well, evaluations. And so for me, I like to step onto the side when someone says, where do we start? What are questions? I like to say, why are we doing trainings if we don't have an ending goal? Why are we doing professional development and we only talk about race one time? Those are just things that the organization has to evaluate in their DNA. What we do is we just expose and say, like we like to say, are you in your diversity audit? What are some things you should be aware of before you keep making this jump? So if you're paying a lot of money and you know to hire someone of color and to retain them, it takes a lot of finances, a lot of time. We want to make sure that you can keep those people that are qualified and can do the job well. And so there's no shortcuts to that. And I think we fix the fix one all be all. And it really does not work if you don't have a plan in place, that the trainings are aligned with other things that the organization is doing.
Are there examples of goals?
Yes. So good. And then,
go ahead.
I don't know. Just wanted to, you talked about this on your article, is just educating yourself. So there's resources, even when you go to the Culture Enough website, we have you do, we send a PDF of like first set of resources for you to start on this journey and to learn. So it's, you already said it in your article about how do I educate myself in this realm as well?
From clients or even just others you've worked with, are there those, you know, JL, you mentioned like, what are good goals? Like what are the right metrics or whatever that sounds right to you?
Yeah, so it depends where it depends what the size of your organization and where you're at. So I'll give you an example. If you're Amazon or Google, even, so example, you're seeing, if you don't know what's happening at Adidas, that a lot of people have walked down we don't take how they are measuring equity and inclusion is so complex and different. But if you're small and medium, some of the same way you say, look at our staff that we work with. Are we 20% people of color? Are we 95%? What do we actually want to get at when it comes to diversity in our organization? Like having tangible numbers. And then another thing you can measure is what professional development are we giving staff to interact cross-culturally? Are we doing service projects? I like to say the best thing you can do to have healthy cross-cultural interactions is actually doing service projects alongside people, because in service projects, you have dialogue. You start to talk when you're painting or you're planting a tree in the community or you're in the, so those are things typically in a work environment that don't exist because you're doing work. So I like to say throughout the year, are we measuring service projects? Are we measuring, honestly, how we deal with conflict, cross-cultural interaction? Those are the small things that you can just start out with as an organization. You don't have to go so big into measuring inclusion, your climate. You can just start so small to say, what are some five things we want to do and how we're going to keep our organization accountable and doing that well?
I want to like walk through, knowing you said it actually well, Jill, so many people, one of the complications is, of course, everyone comes to this topic so differently, so many different perspectives that even in smaller groups that themselves have great range and diversity. But I wonder if we could like work through some examples from, you know, the white leader trying to start here, the Black organizational leader who's like, I've done this interview with, exasperated to feel that they have to constantly be like default spokesperson, to another leader of color who has dynamics in Black communities and within their own. I also would love to unpack maybe some employees who from different backgrounds, either white, Black, or other color, who are unsure how to navigate this. I wonder if we could talk through a couple of examples if you were just giving some advice to folks. So kind of like somewhat arbitrarily, you have, let's start at the employee level. If you're talking to someone who, hey, I can't yet get my organization to take this seriously, you have different pieces of advice on how to start that employee level for people from different backgrounds?
Yeah. And so there's two levels. We do know, I mean, when you're in a leadership position, it's easier to make organizational change. However, what's fascinating is that most employees that I've found that are passionate about this, they've already been doing somewhat of this already. The question is, how do we support what they're already doing so that leadership hears it? So we had a great Latinx Hispanic woman reach out to, and she's in somewhat of a leadership role at this organization. And what's great is that she started to mention at meetings constantly, hey, when we're around, we don't reflect the community that we're serving. It got to a point after a 2-year process, they hired us because of her advocacy. So it's beautiful because sometimes we assume that we don't have a voice. And that's like what we're learning through this movement. We have more of a voice than we think. You can keep your leaderships accountable if they don't do training. If they don't have a diversity task force, you can go to your leaders and say, as an organization, we should have a diversity task force with 3-year goals around diversity and inclusion. Same thing with schools, same thing with the police officers that we put in leadership. And so I think we sometimes assume that the movement is so big where we have to get to, well, I have to start at leadership. But it's like, no, there are things you can do on the level that you can control. And so I just encourage people, it's like, we have more power than we think, especially when you know at this moment, this is an issue that we assume white young millennials and white people care about this topic too. And so you can bring them aboard and say, what does it look like for us to keep leadership accountable? Let's advocate for that.
I think that's powerful. A theme that I think is really, has been a long standing narrative, but I think it seems prominent in the moment, is this relationship between like, this is a white people problem. Like, I think I've heard this narrative that I like a lot, that it is unjust to assume whatever Black leader or any person of color is supposed to take this. This is a white, that is white people's mess. It's great. How lucky you are if there are other people who want to be part of this. That's the start there. But I've seen this tension in the workplace of when folks feel like they'll come across as performative, or they are worrying that they feel unprepared for it, or is it their place to call someone out? And I just wonder if you've done any workshops or any advice or tactical thoughts about those kind of dynamics that seem like a real necessary kind of workplace conversation.
Yeah, I'm going to answer this, and Lisa, I think you can chime in too. Here's what I would say. We forget that diversity and inclusion in some ways, we have not made it a human. We have not humanized it. That we're talking about real people with real emotions, real feelings that have to walk every day in environments that they don't feel valued, cared for, and supported. And so I say this because to start that conversation, we have to come with a, and I'm big into psychological safety around diversity. Before you can talk about diversity, as leaders, you have to understand the uncomfortableness that white people have in the conversation and why. Reality that most white people I've interacted with, not all, their parents have not talked about race. They haven't been, and maybe even had a college professor of color. And then on top of that, they may have never worked under someone of color or have been oversaw by a supervisor of color. So when I see that, I'm like, I'm not shocked why race is uncomfortable. Because we have a group of people that historically haven't talked about it. So we do have to address that because that takes the pressure that people have to be perfect. Evely says we're in this together. And then you have to realize as coworkers in this process, like we talk to our team a lot. We say, if you're going to be vulnerable, it creates a heart connection. Vulnerability creates a heart. Being empathetic and sympathetic is very important. My goal is that we create a space where you can correct me when I'm wrong and I can make mistakes. I'm not perfect. I tell people this all the time. I'm not perfect. But if you understand my posture, if you understand I was a kid who grew up in LA, who wasn't around white people, wasn't around Asian people. I was around Latinx, Hispanic, and Black. I had to learn that. I had to grow in that muscle to get comfortable talking about race. I did a lot of educational things that helped me. And so I like to tell people that if we start there, I think it actually helps us have a posture into the conversation instead of saying, well, you know what? I don't know how to talk about this, so I'm not going to talk about it. Or I'm the expert, and then you say an inappropriate comment. And I think that's what gets leaders in trouble is that they make themselves better than who they are in these conversations that honestly don't create the space of mistakes and psychological safety and even like taking risks. And I think we have seen that historically. I would say we've seen that historically in the Black community is that we less care about what you're going to say and care about the posture of if you're going to be consistent in what you do and how you're going to do it. I've had people say this to me, well, I didn't address it because I didn't know what to say. I think that's a bad excuse. Honestly, I think there's a truth saying, hey, I don't know what to say publicly, but I know there's an issue. Hear that. I don't know what to say. I might say something wrong, but I know there's an issue and we're going to work because we want to be an organization where we know what to say and we have the posture of how to say it in a way that's glorifying our staff people and making it a safe environment.
Yeah. Quickly to add to that, it's almost like white leaders need to go through their own journey. And like how JL said, and these are where trainings are important when done well and when done within a strategy, is that if white people are able to do a training on their own identity and what does it mean? So if I'm a white person, what does it mean to be in a country that has been built on white supremacy and kind of working your way backward, what I need to do now? So you do have to acknowledge white privilege. You have to acknowledge white fragility. And then, yes, there's white guilt. So then what process as a white leader do you need to go through personally in order to understand your own identity? And what does it mean when you walk into a room with a staff of people of color? And understand the emotional intelligence behind that, because simply because the color of your skin, you're able to walk into a room and you have a presence about you already. And so when you understand that, you're now able to lead and work your way backwards in terms of, okay, if that's the case, how do I now lead people of color so that they feel comfortable, they feel psychologically safe to express themselves, to disagree with me, and so that we can move this business or move this mission forward? So it's really having an introspective mindset in terms of how do I lead as a white person?
At some point in an interview, I did something along the lines that bigotry is untended ignorance, meaning that everyone can start with ignorance. Bigotry becomes when you actively protect or maintain that ignorance. And that for me is some of the points here of we all will make mistakes, but if you have the posture, JL, I love that phrase, to do something about it, something different. That said, I wonder, you guys must have really interesting perspectives on cancel culture. And what that means in a workplace of when you cross some line that is very different for lots of different people in the workplace, and someone will say like unacceptable. I struggle with that, about what my advice would be to someone, or do you have those moments where in a workplace someone said that I'm not willing, I'm not giving the psychological safety for that person to make that mistake?
Yeah, I would. So, and this is the one of the most greatest areas, I would say, in the conversation. And here's why. In a structure, we do want to create a restorative practice of like, what does it look like to, you might not be able to, so an individual, we work with a corporation, an individual made a mistake, said a racial comment. They didn't get fired. However, they were no longer able to speak at events. So here they do, like it, but in the process, they also had to start going to counseling. They had to take specific trainings. We do, and I say as a person of color, especially as a Black person interacting, if we create a culture of there's no sense of learning from your mistakes or reconciling from mistakes, it creates what? The lack of psychological safety. Once again, people won't be honest if they can't make mistakes. And now there does come some things if you're bluntly saying disrespectful comments, then yes. However, mm-hmm. I do think as leaders, we do have to create the space to say, what if a staff person says an inappropriate comment? How do you care for the staff person, but also care for the person that has been offended? And typically what I've seen is most people that have been offended rarely would say, I want the staff person to get fired. They care more about what the organization is doing to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And what mm-hmm. happens is organizations don't have a process for that. So what do? They fire the employee quick. So they don't have to say, well, that's not an organization. And I think that's one of the problems that organizations do have, HR have to take ownership in some ways, is saying, did you set this person up well? You didn't. Okay. Did you create a space where they can learn? You didn't. Is it the employee's fault? I mean, let's keep it 100. And I say, is it really the employee's fault, or is it the organization didn't create the space to deal with people around the racial conversation?
Mm-hmm. That seems big. That seems very big, that like, because we've seen it this week, we'll see it any moment. Firing is such a safety valve. Not us. Man, we have that racist asshole here. Glad that guy is gone. That seems big. I wonder unless if you have anything more. That seems really big. Did you set up this person well in the first place? Did the organization, whoever that organization is, a board or a leadership, someone get elevated to a place where they are way out of their depth? And boy, no surprise, they messed up.
Yeah. Can I say one more thing? Sorry, listen, I just want to say one thing.
Yeah.
And this is also the truth. When you see job applications, they don't lift up competencies around diversity and inclusion and cultural intelligence. But then you lift it up when they make a mistake. That's what I'm saying. If you put that in the application, we value cultural competency. Then you can keep people accountable and say, this is a part of our culture. What we're seeing is, and this is what frustrates me. We don't put this in the beginning and have a culture of that. And now it becomes important when someone makes a mistake, which I'm saying, it should have been important at the beginning. You should have had we value diversity and inclusion, and here are the companies you need. So when they sign that application to join your organization, now you can fairly keep them accountable because that's what you told them before. But some people getting fired and they're like, hey, you didn't say this was important. We never even did any training. Now you're going to just fire me because it's important now. And it's always important. But why is it important now? Because they got caught.
That's right. It can come down to simple HR policies. So even when you're, you said, just trying to work your way up in a company, sometimes that becomes more relational than it does policy oriented. So of course, if you have white management, they're going to attract people of the same culture. Whoever's going to golf, if you're part of the club, you'll go to the golf, whatever it's called, field, court, whatever. So it's like you hang around who their same culture is. So if I'm a person of color trying to work my way up a majority white company, what do I have to go through in order to work my way up there? So it ends up becoming more relational than it does, what policies do I have to abide by? What competencies do I have to have in order to work my way up a company, rather than it just being based on culture and color?
We're coming up on time and making clear that, of course, my advice would be all those listening should engage culture enough. Setting that aside as a definite recommendation. I know people have vastly different experience levels or comfort levels. Are there go-to pieces of advice that you'd want to send folks off? And you know, those people might be HR leader at company who might have some degree of training, but this perhaps feels like new territory to them. It could be entrepreneur who's still growing a company and doesn't quite know where cultural competency could be from lots of different backgrounds. It could be an employee from lots of different backgrounds that are trying to navigate their place. It'd just be someone who's like, hell, we don't quite talk about this shit, and I'm not sure if I'm supposed to. Do you have any like pieces of advice, starting points you point people to?
Yeah, I want to speak to two groups, and then at least you can speak to whatever. I want to speak to first minorities in primarily white organizations. In this time, it can create reoccurring trauma when you have to keep explaining what's happening. You have to be the voice. It is okay to say, at this moment, I don't have the capacity, and as an organization, please bring someone else in to talk about this. I am not getting paid to handle another job, and diversity right. and inclusion is a draining topic in itself on top right. of another job. So you have every right to tell your leadership, hey, I don't feel comfortable being the one speaking up on this topic. I'm passionate about it, but I don't want to speak on because it takes me out of experiencing what my other coworkers are experiencing. Mm-hmm. So I do want to give that voice to minority individuals. And then for white leaders who this is important to them, they're trying to figure out where it fits in their organization and they want to make some movement. I'm going to simply say, reach out to Coach Enough. We can work with you in your budget. Start early and don't wait later. Here's what I mean by don't wait later. Yeah. Some people assume when I get bigger, I'll address these issues. It does mm-hmm. not work that way. Because here's how it works this way. I'll create this as my values in the culture now. So when I start to recruit people and hire them, they know this. So when I get bigger, it's not a problem to address this. And we've seen organizations that got bigger say, now we want to address it. And it's hard to move a culture that you've never addressed it for the last 5 to 10 years. And now you want to address it when you have right. 15 to 400 employees and you're trying right. to figure out HR policies, training, onboarding. And so I just think it's important. If you're about this life in the best urban way, I'm saying, if you're about this life, start now because it's going to save you the lawsuits. It's going to save you the hiring process. Right. It's going to save you the onboarding. You're going to retain and recruit minority staff. You're going to know who's with you or not. It saves you so much time. And the research says that you're going to be more productive. You're going to be more right. innovative. But that has to start now and not wait until you say, okay, we'll hire more diversity when we get it, or we'll think about diversity when it becomes important, because the world's not changing. It's only going to become more and more diverse. And I think as leaders, we yeah. have to think about that.
Mm. Yep, absolutely. To add to that, for just to speak to the leader, vulnerable, navigating in space, I don't really know what I'm doing. That's being vulnerable. As well, and that's not a sign of weakness. It's just a sign of you being honest with yourself so that other people can pick it up or other people can chime in and kind of help out. So let's not see vulnerability as a sign of weakness, but it's actually you are so secure in yourself that you understand that this is not my lane. I haven't navigated this before. And so the second point is that's why you call in experts, or that's why you call in outside help. Because it is, when JL talked about, is racial taxation. When you're putting the pressure on your people of color to manage you and to manage your emotions, that is another job description that they didn't sign up for this job. And so it's a term and it's real. And so when you're able to hire companies like Cultured Enough, you're able to bring in an outside perspective, able to walk alongside you and to now think strategically so that you can measure your success and to make it tangible as well. So don't look at vulnerability as a weakness, because it's actually a strength.
That's so powerful, and what a way to go. That's this episode of The Twid Show, an interview series about building better companies. Thank you so much for my guests, JL and Alyssa, from Cultured Enough. We'll have their link in the description. And of course, on the article on Technically, if you found this valuable, of course, like and subscribe. Each week we bring you new episodes on conversations about building better companies. Click around for past episodes. I am Chris Swink. Thank you so much for being here. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.